So today he's talking about Hebrew calligraphy. And if you notice, he's got two more sessions tomorrow. It's kind of part one and part two, morning and afternoon, and morning and afternoon on Wednesday. And there are sign-ups for that on the kiosk. So we'd be it would be lovely for you to join that too. So thank you, Reiner.
Thank you. And the other things,
water.
The other things I'm doing are kind of half and half. One is more kind of the head, more intellectual and study and art history, and the other is more art making and critique. And when I say critique, that's art school talk for people talking about their work, their response to something. And so it's fine if people, if it makes sense for people to come to the first half, it'd be wonderful if people stayed for the second half, but they're kind of two complementary parts. Second half without the first half would really make all that much sense. This is wonderful. Bruchim Habaim, welcome, and hello. So I came here because I'm from Seattle, and I'm friends with Rabbi Johanna Kinberg, and she said, I'm doing this really cool interfaith week with some other people at Holden Village. Have you heard about it? And I said, a little bit, and I did so. And she said that they were looking for people in the arts. So here I am. Because I'm trained as an artist, and you know, I have an MFA. It's kind of like having an English degree in a way. You end up doing lots of different things. And I'm kind of evangelical about really looking at the big picture of things creative and cultural. And my background is Jewish. And one of the things about being Jewish is it's a complex identity. And often people think, oh, the Jewish faith. But in reality, being Jewish is an ethnicity. It's a spiritual tradition, a wisdom tradition. It's a, you know, it's many, actually quite a few different cultures and languages. It's complicated. And because of that, I think it's really useful when looking at anything to look at the creative, the cultural, the wisdom tradition, the spiritual, the history, all these things in an integrated way. So that's the approach I'm taking. So I'm not really exactly doing a workshop about Hebrew calligraphy per se. I'm doing a workshop about the Hebrew letters. And if any of you are interested, I can do some demonstration later on, and you can, I have some handouts, and we can talk a little bit. Maybe you might want to try your hand. I have some basic materials. So that will be at the tail end. So one of the things to know about Hebrew letters, first of all, is the name for a letter in Hebrew is Ot. And Ot can mean a lot of different things. I have the impression that lots of people who come to Holden Village are fairly conversant in the Bible. And so you may have heard the phrase, to bind it as a sign upon your hand and between your eyes. Jews say that after our profession of faith, the Shema, we say the Lehavta, and you shall love God with all your heart and all your might, and as you rise up and as you go on your way, and you shall bind these words as a sign, as literally as a letter on your hand, and as a letter between your eyes. And from that comes the tradition of tefillin, phylacteries. And when you wrap with tefillin, you're making the shape of the letter shin on your hand, the way it's bound. And then the tefillin shel rosh, the phylacteries for the head, have the parchment that has the Shema and the Vahavta, the perfect statement of faith. Listen, everyone, God is our God, etc. And that statement of you shall love God with all your heart and all your might. So, Ot, the word for a letter, is a sign, it's a proof, it's a symbol. It can be translated as a miracle, and it's letters. And oat is spelled Aleph Vav Tav. And one of the things that's important to know about the Hebrew Aleph Beit, the Hebrew alphabet, is that is the historical and cultural significance it's had. And you can get a sense of this when we do this. So Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet, and it's actually a silent letter. And Vav means it is the, I always have to do this. It's the sixth letter in the alphabet, but it's also the, is means and. And Tav is the last letter in the alphabet. So really, when you write the word oat, the word letter, you're writing the beginning and the end. Alpha and Omega, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the beginning and the end, united by kind of that powerful and. So you can see that already the Hebrew letters have a disproportionate importance, really, in terms of the whole of Jewish identity and culture. And part of this is historically based, because the Jewish people have a history of having to move, under duress, with the beginning of the diaspora, and even before, with the beginning of the first diaspora under Babylonian rule, with the beginning of the second diaspora after the Roman oppression and the destruction of the temple, and subsequently with having to leave places under duress and find other places that were safer, what did people have to carry with them except for the Aleph Beit? And, we couldn't carry cathedrals, sanctuaries in space with us. We carried sanctuaries of time in the form of the Shabbat, the Sabbath, and we carried, and of course the rest of the calendar, but we also carried the letters. And so the letters are powerful symbols. In the tradition, it really makes sense. This quote, a symbol speaks to the whole human being and not only to the intelligence. The letters became a powerful cultural symbol. The interpretation of the letters became really inexhaustible. And we'll talk about that a lot more. They always occurred within a social context in terms of how people developed their interpretation of the significance of the Aleph Beit. And there is emotional content as well as the whole history of study. And it is kind of infinitely expandable. In Hebrew, all the words come from a root. And so by the way, when you're looking at Hebrew letters, the first sound in the name of the letter is basically the sound. So Aleph, Mem, Nun. The Shoresh is the root. For example, the root for, you mentioned Shalom. The root for Shalom is basically Salam. Or actually, even better, if I were going to write it in Latin letters like that, S-L-M. And I say Salam because the letter, the first letter is interchangeable with a sin or a shin. Salam, Shalom. So from that root comes the word for peace, hello and goodbye, completeness, harmony, wholeness. For example, the name Hebrew for Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, has this in it. Unfortunately, Yerushalayim is not the Yerushalem, the Yerushalom, the city of completeness and peace that it could be. But Hebrew works that way, that root, you know, you have the root and then all sorts of interpretations branch out from that. And so a cool thing for me as an artist is that the Aleph Mem Nun Shoresh, or root, is the source for Amen, which literally means so be it, Emunah, which means faith, and Omanut, which means art or craft. So I think it's very nice that when people make art, they're expressing a type of faith and confirmation of what it means to be a human being, simply because of that root, that work. There's also an important Jewish idea that's very, very important for anybody working with Hebrew letters, or for that matter, anybody involved in arts, called Hidur Mitzvah. And it means to, literally, to embellish, adorn, or make beautiful the commandment. A mitzvah literally means a commandment, but I prefer to translate it as a positive action or a positive restraint. And so, an example of making something beautiful would be to make a kiddush cup, the cup that is used every Saturday night to bless wine, as beautifully as possible. And I think those of you who come from a Christian background, especially those of you who are Lutherans, because I've been having a cultural experience myself here, you know, like last night when you did the Eucharist, you can understand what I'm talking about, to make the things that you use in expressing your identity of a certain sort as beautiful as possible. That's Hidur Mitzvah. And this very, very definitely applies to Hebrew writing. And Hebrew calligraphy in Hebrew is called Ketivah Tama. Ketivah means to write, and Tama means a lot of different things. It means miraculous, kind of astonishing, and also innocent. But I like the idea that calligraphy in Hebrew means basically astonishing writing. And if anybody has any questions at any point, please don't hesitate to ask. Yeah?
At some point, could you bring in the... I was told that the Hebrew word for L'chaim is the 18 equivalent, so there's a numerical equivalent.
Ah, okay. So Hebrew letters have numerical value.
Yeah.
And the term for working with that is gematria. And our ancestors had much more time on their hands than we appear to now. And okay. And really, really got into the really, really detailed interpretation of things. But the Hebrew word chai is life. And yeah. So this word, this letter is a chet, a ch sound, and a yud. By the way, you notice that in order to spell this completely, I have to put in vowels. So you read Hebrew from right to left, and if you're having to sound out the word, you're reading like that. Because Hebrew, for the most part, is a consonant-based language, as is Arabic as well. There are certain letters, and we'll get into that a little bit more, that function as vowels. And Hebrew is used to write Jewish languages. Can people think of some Jewish languages?
Aramaic and Yiddish.
Yiddish, yeah. And Hebrew?
Hebrew, of course. Yeah.
Can you think of any others?
Ladino.
Judeo-Arabic, Judeo-Persian, Judeo-Greek. Jews lived in the midst of other cultures and developed their own vernacular. The oldest ones, of course, are Hebrew and Aramaic. It was kind of interesting at one point. What was the Mel Gibson movie about? I think about. Was it Mel Gibson and the movie about Jesus? And I remember seeing something in it about how incredible it was they were using Aramaic. We use Aramaic all the time. Some of the most important Jewish prayers are in Aramaic.
Today.
And yes, and for example, in the Passover Haggadah, the Mourner's Kaddish that we say whenever we have a minion and anybody who is, it's the anniversary of a death or during the year of mourning, that's Aramaic. And actually, the Lord's Prayer is, the language of it is quite close to the language of the Mourner's Kaddish. Anyway, the thing that really unites all Jewish languages, whether they're Ladino or Yiddish or Hebrew or Aramaic or those other languages I mentioned, is that they are written in Hebrew characters. So, one important thing to be aware of is that the Hebrew that I'm teaching you is not called Hebrew in Hebrew. It's called Ketuv Ashuri, which means kind of like Assyrian or Aramaic writing, in contrast to Ketuv Ivri, which means Hebrew writing. So that's kind of surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let's get into a bit of history. So first of all, Hebrew comes from a pictographic origin. And you can see that with some of the letters even now, but in their form, but definitely in terms of their names. So here's some Proto-Sinaitic, I don't really say that out loud very often, inscriptions from the Sinai. And you can see that there are certain things, for example, the ox head and wavy lines and things that look kind of like heads. And some people, there's an argument going on about exactly how Hebrew letters developed. And there's a possibility that it really was because the area of the Sinai and the Egyptian Delta were a meeting place of cultures, and that perhaps it was very influenced by hieroglyphics. So, as it began to, there were about 19 or so signs that could have been inspired by hieroglyphic writing, but this proto-Sinaitic writing began to spread and is heading in the direction of modern Hebrew. So, Aleph is an ox. By the way, in military terminology, an Aleph is the commander of a battalion. Yeah?
Since the letters originated in Egypt, are there a lot of Hebrew speakers in Egypt, like present today?
Are there Hebrew speakers in Egypt now?
Like a...
No, not really, but Egypt was a powerful force, culturally and politically. So it wouldn't be surprising that they would have a considerable amount of influence on the cultures around them. Beth or Beit is house, Gimel is camel, Dalet is door, the Vav or the Wow, depending on what your background is. Zayin is literally a weapon. Chet is like a screen or a window. Yud is a hand. Lamed is an ox goad. Mem is mayim, water. Ayin is an eye. And resh is a head. The Hebrew for head is rosh. Kuf is the eye of a needle. Tav is literally like a sign, and shin or sin are teeth. And this is just one manifestation of the letters. And as we move along, here is the Phoenician alphabet. A lot of these scripts are really closely related. The Phoenician alphabet is what inspired Greeks to start developing their alphabet with modifications, and while Hebrew continued to develop. So this is Hebrew writing. And as you can see, the name for this literally is Hebrew writing. Ivri is Hebrew. It means like the usual interpretation of its origins. Ivri, Hebrew, is one who crosses boundaries, who crosses borders. But you can see, again, like the sin or shin fang here, and the yud, you know, the hand, and so on. You can still see the ox. And the way that the mim has a liquid form. Actually, I think I have a, oh cool, I have a laser pointer on here. And a modified form of the script, of this particular script, is still used by Samaritans now. There's very, very few of them. It's a tiny community, but they still use the script, a modified form. So in terms of development of alphabets, basically humans are impatient. We simplify, we symbolize, the pictograph becomes an ideograph, and then becomes alphabetic vocalization. And a nice example of how human impatience works is the word, is this symbol for beer from the area of Mesopotamia. This is not Hebrew, of course, but it's a good example. So we start, with literally a jar of fermenting beer. It turns onto its side, and then they start using those kind of wedge, those wedge-shaped stamp styluses. And you can see the development until finally, it's simply, maybe because they've had so much beer, and wise. So this is a good example of how a pictographic image from the Middle East went through a process of dramatic simplification and became very abstract. So this gives a sense of how Hebrew continued to develop. The Hebrew writing here, and then here, what is called Kitab Oshuri, or Merubah. Merubah comes from literally square writing. Oshuri could be either interpreted as being Assyrian writing, or Syrian writing, or Aramaic writing. And this is beginning to look a lot more like you think of Hebrew looking, correct? So Hebrew is, like I said, basically consonant based. We have a couple of silent consonants, the aleph and the ayin. There's some difference in how you vocalize. These two letters can be associated with a lot of different vowels, but when it comes to the vowels, and such, there's a difference in how it's pronounced. And you can probably hear, you probably heard how I was pronouncing them differently. I wasn't saying aleph and ayin, I was saying aleph and ayin. It's like deeper down in the throat, ayin. And for people who are Hebrew speakers who are Mizrahi or from Morocco, if people came from Arabic-speaking countries, the ayin is really strong. You can tell the accent. And in Arabic, the ayin is even deeper in the throat. And Arabic and Hebrew are sister languages, along with Amharic, which is, you know, one of the dominant languages in Ethiopia. So here is an early example of what we think of as modern Hebrew writing. This would be from about 2,000 years ago. And then this is an ancient Aramaic script from Egypt. It was found Jewish garrison in the area of Elephantine on the Nile River. And you can see that this is also beginning to be quite calligraphic in its form, and has its own idiosyncratic quality to it. But it's pretty recognizable. This is from the 4th century BC. It's a letter from that garrison to the high priest in Jerusalem, basically asking questions about protocols of ritual and how to maintain a community in the middle of Egypt. So I mentioned sister languages before, and this is about what you mentioned about saying you could recognize the word shalom. So here is shalom, and this is written without all the vowels. There should be a little mark like so for an ah sound beneath the shin, the SH sound, and a little dot right there. And that makes it into a shin. And lamed, an L sound. The vav, or wow, can be O or U. And the final mem. And we have several final letters. We have mem, nun, fe, and sadi have final forms. And then this is a sin, a lam, and a mim. And then in Amharic, it's syllable based. The letters are modified just a little bit, you know, to make the syllable, like they would have sa, se, so, su, si, with a slight modification of the letter. But you can see that they've got sa, la, ma to make salam, and the Arabic salam in the Hebrew shalom. But remember with what I mentioned earlier, that in Hebrew, certain sounds are kind of interchangeable because of how you accent the letter. And for example, a bet and a vet are the same letter, a but and v sound, depending on whether you have what's called the dagesh, the dot in the middle of the alphabet, shin and sin, kaf and chaf, and so on. So, you've heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were created during the Second Temple period, more than 2,000 years ago. And there's an interesting thing going on in the Dead Sea Scrolls. These were written during a time of great cultural stress and change, a time of revolution and oppression, a time of extreme spiritual ferment. For those of you who are Christian, the figure of Jesus was not the only Messiah who was in circulation. It was a period of many messiahs because there was such upheaval going on and competing schools of how to deal with that upheaval. And the Dead Sea Scrolls represent a particular sect of Jewish expression. This is also a period of enormous evolution in what it meant to be Jewish, and including the Pharisees and the Sadducees. One thing to comment about, by the way, is that in Jewish tradition, the Pharisees are the good guys. They are the ancestors of modern Judaism. They tended to be more working class, whereas the Sadducees were upper class and affiliated with the temple. The Pharisees were the founders of the synagogue. And some of the greatest Jewish teachers, historical teachers, like Hillel and so on, were Pharisees. And, you know, from a Jewish perspective, we understand that this was a kind of upheaval and of competing ideologies, and people who were rebelling against certain aspects of it might get called out by people who already were established teachers. So from a Jewish perspective, when we talk about Pharisees, it's kind of different from a lot of the Christian interpretation. Well, significantly different. And so that's something to be aware of when you talk about Pharisees. There are certain historical sensitivities to be aware of. In any case, a period of great upheaval, including with writing. So in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there is a mixture of writing. This is a Leviticus, and this is in Ketuv Ivri, in ancient Hebrew writing. This is what's called Sefer HaMilchama, which really means the Book of War. And this is done in the square Hebrew script. So you can probably recognize this basically as being the equivalent of modern Hebrew writing. This is that ancient, more pictographic writing. So this is, this right here is Israel. So that's a Yud, Yud, S-R-A-L. The interesting thing is that there are certain things that people hang on to because we're also inherently conservative. Can anybody, can I have a volunteer to point out where the Hebrew script changes in this calligraphy of a psalm?
Where it changes,
where there's a different script used.
You have a narrow slanted lines going high right to down left, right just where you just passed. Yeah, right there.
Yeah, can you guess what this might be? Remember I said people are often inherently conservative. They hang on to certain ways of doing things when they're really, really important. Any guesses about what this word might be?
Beer?
It's Yud Hey Vav Hey, which sometimes gets pronounced as Yahweh. So this is the Yud Hey Vav Hey is kind of the, in a way, the unpronounceable name of God. People have tried to interpret it different ways, like Jehovah is definitely a mispronunciation. Yahweh, well, I prefer just to use the spell it out, Yud Hey Vav Hey, YHVH essentially. It's an interesting word because one theory is that it has all the conjugations of the verb to be. So another way to translate this name for God is Israel, is, was, is, will be. But anyway, in the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of their contemporary surviving documents, the name of God is always written in Hebrew writing as compared to Aramaic writing. So, you know, remember, this is what I'm calling Hebrew writing. And so, and it literally is spelled like hand, window, hook, window. Because remember, the letters came from a pictographic source. And it's kind of fun working with kids to have them play with this, because we talk about making midrash, about storytelling and creative work to fill in what's not written down already. And one of the examples of midrash that I've done with kids is to ask, why would the word for truth, emet, be spelled ox, water, sign? And they come up with some great ideas about stubbornness, but also the power of water, and how you need to sometimes stamp and seal something to say it's truthful. So the pictographic origins of the letters really offer some fun. Hebrew letters have taken a lot of different shapes and forms. This is Hebrew from the 5th century from Galilee. One of the things about some of these letters that's fun is to once again look at the pictographic source. This is Gimel, and this kind of illustrates some things about how a pictographic form might get simplified, like we talked about earlier, become more abstract. So Gimel started out being a camel. And then the camel got impatient. Wow. And then the camel sat down. So this is a gimel here.
Oh. Wow.
And this is how, these are a couple of different ways that the letter resh, the R sound, was written, because it started out being a head, and then it lost the face. Oops, what just happened here?
Got that at you.
The letter hey, okay, it means mouth. This is from Spain, and there are different Jewish scripts. Rashi, which is named after the famous rabbi from southern France from the 11th century, is used for commentary, for Talmudic commentary. And it's also used to write Ladino. The language of Sephardic Jews who originated in the Iberian Peninsula, Ladino is a mixture of Hebrew, old Castilian Spanish, and Arabic. But, you know, those of you who would speak Spanish would be able to understand a lot of Ladino. And it's interesting, too, that this is also has some kind of ancestral forms of Hebrew cursive. Like, for example, this is a mem. And that's pretty much the way a mem is written in cursive now. So the Hebrew letters take a lot of different forms. For example, this is a shin, and it lost its three forks. There is a rich tradition of Hebrew illuminated manuscripts. As I said before, books and writing was often the only thing people could take with them when they had to pick up and move. And this is a Sephardic Spanish illuminated piece. There is a strong influence in certain kinds of Hebrew illuminated manuscripts from the Islamic tradition. For example, what are called carpet pages, where there's abstract forms that often literally have kind of the decorative quality of a carpet. However, there's something else going on in here, which is a very specifically Jewish calligraphic custom that's called micrography, where very small writing is used to make forms. This is a Sephardic calligraphic hand. And in the Jewish tradition, calligraphic tradition, what the tools that you use to write with influence the nature of the script. So in the Sephardic and Eastern or Mizrahi tradition, they used a reed pen. This is a pen that you can pass around that I cut from a piece of bamboo. Bamboo is not the traditional material, but you can do pretty good calligraphy with that. And reed pen is stiffer inherently. So people who lived around the Mediterranean and in the Middle East used reed pens to write with. And then people in Northern Europe and Eastern Europe used goose quills. The sturdy quills from a bird's wing. And they've got different qualities. This is a Yemenite manuscript pen, and you can see that the strokes are very strong and sturdy, which is the kind of thing that happens that you can do with a reed pen. By the way, Arabic is usually written with a reed pen. And whereas Hebrew and Latin characters are done pulling the nib most of the time, Arabic is often written with pushing the nib. You can't do that very well with, for example, a metal nib because it'll catch on your writing surface. But you can do it with a reed nib. However, with a quill, a quill is much more flexible and lends itself to certain kinds of things we'll see in a moment. This is also a Yemeni illuminated script. You can see what I mean about micrography, where forms are made out of writing, and also the idea
Could
of a carpet
that
page.
Word again, please. Is it micro?
Micrography.
So micro, like little?
Micrography, yeah, essentially.
Okay. Little writing.
Micrographic.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's a very specific Jewish calligraphic tradition, scribal tradition. When we look at illuminated manuscripts from countries where the majority culture was Muslim, tend to be much more abstract. Jewish illuminated manuscripts from countries where the majority culture was Christian tended to be often more representational. And in Jewish, in the Jewish artistic history of Jewish artistry, there's a concept push and pull between representation of human forms. But that's a whole nother topic. However, this wasn't always consistent. For example, this is a Persian manuscript. And Iran, or Persia, for much of its history, actually was much more permissive about representation of the human form. This is kind of a rather gory illumination, and this is from the Book of Esther, where Haman, who plotted genocide, does not succeed. This is an intermediate script. This is from southern France. So this is interesting because it's between the Sephardic tradition and the Ashkenazi tradition. So it has some of the quality of both. And then this is just delightful. This is taking animal forms and such and making them into letters. And this says, Ani Yosef Hasafarti. I, Yosef the Frenchman, illustrated and completed this. So occasionally with these old illuminated manuscripts, we actually find out who the artist was.
The shin is third over on this side and fourth over on that side.
Well, this is sent the order of the Hebrew alphabet. So this is actually about completing. Remember I said that the shin, mem, shin, lamed, mem, kind of S-L-M, means complete. And
that's
so...
It's like the end?
He completed it.
Okay.
So it's got the same root as shalom. As a matter of fact, in modern Hebrew, if I were to ask any of you how you're doing, if I were going to say to a man, I would say, Ma shlomcha, literally, how's your peace? How's your completeness? To a woman, I would say, Ma shlomech. So anyway, that's showing right here, too, to make something complete.
Okay, thank you.
So this is from Germany. This is Ashkenazi. And this is working with a quill pen. So you can see that there's these really, really fine strokes. And there's these little kind of calypse with the serifs in places like right there. See the little points? Or for that matter, you can see here how literally the pressure that you're using with the quill can really affect the quality of the stroke. So there's a substantial difference between Sephardic and Middle Eastern script and Ashkenazi, Central European, Eastern European script. And the what people think of as stereotypical writing in a Torah scroll, they usually think of Ashkenazi script. Here is a delightful illumination. And one of the things you see with these these illuminators is that there's kind of an interesting sense of humor at work. And it's interesting because this is a Mishnah Torah, one of the great commentaries on Torah by Maimonides. And this says Sefer Sheni, literally the second book. So this is a really, really important commentary. And here's someone getting shot in the tush with an arrow. Here's some more illuminations. This is very significant. You can see that this figure doesn't have a human face. So this is from the late 13th, early 14th century. This was from Central Europe and Germany and Central Europe. And this is a time of extreme danger for Jewish communities because it's the period of the Crusades. And what happened during the time of the Crusades is often as people traveled to the Middle East to fight the infidel, they practiced on the way. And Jewish communities were decimated. And so there is a period, one of the responses people have to extreme oppression is to believe that if they become more traditional, if they become more fundamentalist in a sense, that if they just obey the commandments more, if they're really literal, that something that will make them safer. It's a logical, one of the different ways that people respond psychologically. And this is expressed in a couple of different ways. One is prescription, the prohibition in many cases of showing human form. So this is So there, another example, this is what's called the Bird's Head Haggadah, where it's the Passover Haggadah, but the characters have bird heads. Another theory is that these are actually, that the Jewish characters are actually shown as griffins. And in other words, as having kind of a supernatural power. This is actually something that I did, and this is a Rosh Hashanah card, but here we have, I did some artwork inspired by Bird's Head Haggadah, and this is from an illustration I did for Passover.
Does that say Rosh Hashanah Tova?
That says Kol HaShofar, the voice of the shofar. So, you know, you saw that earlier Persian manuscript where it's very influenced, obviously, by the culture around it. And this is an example of how in Europe, during the Middle Ages, Jewish manuscripts would be influenced by the culture around them. And then here is another incredible example of micrography. So here's some examples, once again, of different hands. This is from a friend of mine who is a wonderful calligrapher named Gina Jonas. What she identified as ancient Hebrew is inspired by the script in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is Sephardic script, and this is Ashkenazi script. So, and when you think of, when a lot of people think about Hebrew writing for liturgical purposes, they often think of the Ashkenazi script. But once again, the tools that people were using were really critical. You might notice these little crowns, those are called tagin or keterim. Tagin is Aramaic, keterim literally means crowns, it's Hebrew. And those are used on certain letters that have the form of the letter Zion in them in one way or another. As you can see here, it's this shape with a stem that shapes whether it has the little crowns. And this is called Ketav Stam, Ketav writing, and Stam is an acronym for the Torah scroll, Tefillin, and mezuzahs. And there are very specific customs associated with that. And these customs are all associated with the scribal arts. And there are very, very particular rules that are used. For example, use parchment and for these particular items. And it has to be from a kosher animal. Cow, goat, sheep, deer, bison. You could use kosher birds, but that would be kind of challenging. And according to rabbinic sources, don't use fish skin. And why not? Because the teaching is that probably would stink. And it would go against the idea of making the commandment beautiful. And the animal doesn't need to be slaughtered according to kosher slaughter rules, but there are scribes who really try to seek out the most ethical way to obtain their writing surfaces. And when people are doing writing for the Torah scroll and related items, you only score it to make your writing lines. You don't use a pencil or something similar. When doing a sofer scroll, you don't use any base metals. You don't use, basically, you don't use anything that can be used for killing. So the writing implements are things like quills or reeds. And this is inspired by the teaching from Exodus. If you build an altar of stones to me, you shall not use dressed stone. If you lift your sword to it, you pollute it. There's this idea, again, of not using anything that can cut and destroy. And there's a whole controversy about that at the Sabbath table with the challah, with the special bread. In my household, we don't cut the bread on Friday nights because the word for war, milchama, has the letters for lechem, bread in it. People fight wars to survive, right, to have what they need. So we rip it apart, but then I've encountered some other families that said, no, you don't rip it apart, that's like being like wild animals. So it's not actually totally forbidden, but a lot of scribes just think it's inappropriate. That associations with violence, and you don't want that, anything that has a connection with violence to be associated with making a Torah scroll. And actually, some people have done interesting things with gold and silver and glass. But here's an example of some reed pins. And there's a whole scribal arts aspect to cutting your quills or trimming your pen. The ink is made in a special way from oak galls, from a mineral salt, and from gum arabic. And then sometimes certain things are added to intensify the color of the ink. And if you look closely at a Torah scroll, it almost looks like the letters are embossed if it's not a really, really old Torah scroll. Okay, so now we're kind of circling back to what I said at the beginning, which is about the incredible significance of the letters as a heritage and as a part of the wisdom tradition. So a Torah scroll has to be kosher. It can't have any broken letters in it. And if the letters faded or partly illegible, then the Torah scroll is invalid. It's not kosher for use in a context of worship. And scribes do a lot of work repairing Torahs, going back into the Torah and touching it up and connecting things and working with faded letters. There's one exception in the whole Torah, what we call the broken vav. And it's in Numbers. It's the word shalom, and it must be written with a break. So the O sound in shalom is written that way. And why? Because this is when there was a plague in the camp, and Pinchas the priest kills a man who's making love to a non-Israelite woman. He kills both of them. And the plague ends, and theoretically peace is returned to the camp, peace and health. But somebody at some point said, this is really uncomfortable. And the tradition began centuries and centuries ago of writing that broken vow, that peace, that demonstrates that peace cannot be achieved through violence. And every Torah scroll in the world is fundamentally identical. There are some scrolls that are set up a little bit differently. For example, a lot of the scrolls that I have contact with, every column in it starts with the letter Vav, and, the word and. But every Torah scroll has that broken Vav. There's other fun things about how Hebrew writing is used in a liturgical context. This is the beginning of the Torah, Bereshit, with that great big bet, that B sound. Bereshit means in the beginning. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then, so at the beginning of the Torah, there's that great big bet. At another point in the Torah, there's the Shema, which means listen, O Israel, God is our God, God is one. And in the word for listen, Shema, often translated also as hear, the last letter is written really big. And then in the word Echad, the last letter is written really big. And the reason for that is twofold. One is that those two letters together make the word witness, Ed. And also, the letter for a D sound and the letter for an R sound are very similar. And you wouldn't want to say, let's see, I have to remember how to do it. You can say Shema, perhaps, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is another. So you want to make sure that people read it right. Because Acher means another, and Echad means one. And, you know, if you're being sloppy with your writing, it can be messed up. In the letter, pe, a P sound, pe or fe, in this traditional writing for a Torah scroll, there's always the letter bet hidden in there. And we've already talked about, there's a missing vav. This is getting rather technical. So in Exodus, there's a place where there's a character here that's missing, and olam, lil olam means either to olam either means universe or forever, and without with the missing letter that would go right there, it can also be read as concealed, which means that the pronunciation of God's name is unknowable. In Jewish tradition, when we talk about God, we often say Hashem. Hashem means the name. And then we have all sorts of metaphors, right? The compassionate, etc. Adonai, which means literally Lord. But God doesn't really have a name. There's backward letters. And one of the this is a very significant line in the Torah. When we take when we take out the scroll during a Torah service, when the scroll is read, this is always read. And this is when Moses is talking about the enemies of the holy will always be defeated. This is considered to be a separate book in the Bible by some interpretations. And Rabbi Simeon ben Gamliel said that when the Messiah comes, these letters will be put back in their correct direction. This is what I referred to when I said that in the statement of faith, that there are two letters that are much larger. So this is at the end of the word for listen, and this is at the end of the word for one. So every Torah in the world, every Torah scroll in the world is written this way. And these are customs that have evolved over centuries, and it's kind of remarkable that there's this consistency. at the beginning of the book of Leviticus, the first word in the book of Leviticus has a tiny aleph. So, if you're going to be a sofer, a scribe, for Torah scrolls, mezuzahs, and so on, it takes a lot of knowledge and a lot of training, which is why I would never do it. I do Hebrew calligraphy, but I'm not willing to make that commitment, because there's just so much that you need to know.
And so they are all handwritten? Is
yes.
that true?
Yeah. A Torah scroll is made of, it's made out of panels, and they're stitched together with sinew. They are in scroll form. A Torah scroll, a typical Torah scroll, let's see, unrolled, would go around this room about two times. And it takes a typical scribe about a year to write the Torah scroll. There are unique textual layouts. This is the Ten Commandments, or as we say in our tradition, the Ten Utterances. And you can see that there's a very specific layout. This is the word no, 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 no. The negative utterances. And this is the song at the sea. When the Jews have crossed the Sea of Reeds and the pursuing army of the oppressor has been swept away, and Miriam sings with the women. And so it's very useful because when you're going through a Torah scroll looking for the place you're going to read, there's these very distinctive layouts that you can look for. A Torah scroll is written without punctuation, without vowels, and it's chanted according to a specific, what is called nusach, or melody. And so the people who work at reading Torah, it's a skill. And traditionally, when someone has a bar bat mitzvah, this is what they're learning. It's the biggest project they've ever done. My son, when he did it, he had to do certain kinds of work, you know, to do, you know, to help the community, to you know, to social justice things and so on. He had to learn to read Hebrew, etc., etc. He had to he had to study the Torah reading, the biblical reading for that particular day, which was about building a sanctuary. And then he had to write a speech about it. He became the rabbi for the day. He led a significant amount of the service. He did the rabbinic teaching. So it's a big, and he also had to learn how to chant Torah, to read without vowels, without punctuation, and get the melody right. And Torah is read three days of the week. The first two, the times during the weekdays were market days traditionally. Everybody was in town for a market. Ezra the scribe began this tradition. And then on the Sabbath, yeah?
How many years would that be that your son studied all those things?
He did it over about a 14-month period.
14 months.
Yeah. Nobody else could see all the things that we had pounded into the Sabbath. Wow. And he did a fine job, and then he said, I've had enough of this for a while. But in any case, yes, he read material like this.
Uh-huh.
I know how to read Torah. My problem is I'm not very good with melody. The Hebrew reading is fine. The thing I get caught up on is remembering the melody. And it's a real challenge for me. But hey, if I can read Torah, almost anybody can.
How do they teach the melody? Is it by imitation, or is there a musical notation also?
I would need to show you a page from, like, from what we call a Chumash, the five books of Moses. There would be the vowels, and there would be other certain other marks. So, for example, at the end of a verse is Sof Pasuk, which already means the end of a the verse end. And so it's Sof Pasuk. You know, there's things like Mapah Eknachta, Munach Katom. Those are, and those are the notes, the melody for particular places in the sequence of reading. And it's kind of for people who actually have a sense of melody. It's a mnemonic device.
Yeah.
And for some of us, it's more challenging.
So when you're reading the Torah, how long does it take? I mean, when you said you do it 3 times a week, when you're reading it to a group, for like 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
It depends. Different people have different customs about what they read. Most Jewish congregations split it up into a triennial cycle. So literally 1/3 of each Torah reading is done per week. And there's a Torah reading for every week, and there's one Torah reading that's one portion, two portions are treated as kind of a combined portion. And then also we have a lunar calendar, and so every so often we have an extra month. But anyway, yeah, it's broken up into kind of manageable parts. And some congregations do the whole darn thing. It takes a long time. But most of the community is a bit more impatient. So there's, I mentioned the word midrash, which is rabbinic storytelling. And just to emphasize the importance of the letters, there's these incredible stories. First of all, tradition tells us that the letters were created before the world was created. And so we talk about Aleph-Bet of creation. We talk about how the Torah was given in, the Torah is white fire, and the letters with which it's engraved are black fire. It is fire surrounded by fire, engraved out of fire, and set in fire. There's just a lot comparing the letters to fire. And how did God create the heavens? Some say that God wrapped a talit of light, a prayer shawl of light, suffusing the world, and that garment was covered with the letters inscribed in black fire on white fire. There is the idea that every Jew is represented by one letter of the Torah, and that the number of people who gathered at Mount Sinai were equivalent to all the letters in the Torah, numerically. And then there's stories about how which letters were used to create the universe. There's this that idea that before the creation of the world there were no animals, therefore no skins for parchment. And so that's why the Torah was written on the arm of God with black fire and white fire. And God took the Torah and placed it in front of God, you know, like a very circular kind of thing, and read it from the beginning to end. And as the words were read, they came to pass. So there's all these stories that really are about the letters and about writing. When God appeared before Moses in the burning bush, there were 22 letters written before him with devouring flame. These letters formed the mystical image of God, and by peering into those burning letters, Moses was able to interpret God's presence and expound the law. And then there's flying letters. When Moses comes down from the mountain and sees the people worshiping the golden calf, he throws the tablets on the ground, and then the letters fly up into the heavens. Before the world was created, the letters flew around without order, and nothing existed but chaos. And to bring order out of chaos, God arranged the letters beginning with the first letter, Aleph. And then, sorry about the typos here, God chose Bet to begin the Torah, and after that, each letter took its place. There's a wonderful midrash that the artist Ben Shahn illustrated. It's called the Aleph Beit, or the alphabet of creation. And all the letters are competing with God before God to begin to write the Bible. And every letter has a problem. Like the letter Resh begins the word Ra, which means evil. And so on and so forth. And the letter Bet goes up before God and says, every day when people say prayers, they're going to use me to praise you. They're going to say, Baruch, blessed. And God is wowed by this. And so, Bet is the first letter in the Torah. Because Bereshit means in the beginning. And then the letter Aleph has been quiet all this time. And God asks, why are you being quiet? And the letter Aleph is very modest and said, I didn't want to take away from my fellow letters' glory. So I thought they should go before me. And God is so impressed by the humble character of the letter Aleph that the letter Aleph is the first letter in the 10 utterances, the 10 commandments. There's letters sometimes are used to express a sense of tragedy. This is in the Yom Kippur service where in what's called the martyr elegy, the people who died for refusing to give up their faith. So Rabbi Hanina ben Taradion was wrapped in the Torah scroll and set on fire by the Romans for daring to teach the Torah in public. His students asked, Rabbi, what do you see? Rabbi Hanina replied, the parchment is burning, but the letters are soaring on high. And here's one of my favorite ones. Rabbi Judah fell asleep and dreamed, saw Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai ascending on high, bearing a Torah scroll in his arms. Behind him flew a flock in formation of letters, not birds. Rabbi Judah watched them all disappear and was mystified until he understood that Rabbi Shimon had died. The world had lost a store of precious knowledge, which returned to its source on high. So this is what I mean by flying letters. And then the idea that God's signature is in the Torah, because the first letters, the last letters of the first three letters of the Torah spell truth. And then I like this idea that when Adam and Eve were created, they were clothed in garments of letters, of luminous letters, which shone like a torch. So this is an example. This is rabbinic midrash. There's a really rich tradition of this kind of storytelling, and which has just it's wonderful stuff to work with. And people had a lot of time before technology came along to really play with them things. The letter Yud, which is like a Y sound, often, not always, is the smallest letter. It's like a point. That's the one that comes from a hand, almost literally like this. And in Yiddish, Yid means Jew. Yiddish, right? Yiddish means Jewish. I mean, just like, you know, French. You know, it was the Jewish language of Eastern Europe, in addition to Hebrew. So Yud, there's a pun here, wordplay. Yud is the Pentel Yid, the little Jew. And it's the point, the beginning of process, a hand, a building block. It's the 10th. Yud is a numeric value of 10. So it's the final person to make a minion. The count of 10, That means you can actually do a complete prayer service. And of course, 10 is very significant because when Abraham argued with God about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, he says, if I can find 50 righteous people, will you save the city? And finally, if I can find 10 righteous people, will you save the city? The argument doesn't go lower than that. But the number 10 is very significant. And then with Yud, with the letter Yud, which is like this, if it's done with a calligraphic stroke, the point, the seraph points upward towards the heavens, and the drawnward stroke goes to the earth, and the middle unites. So heaven and earth are united in this one tiny little letter. And there's a bit more here about the more esoteric qualities of the letters. The letter Shin is one of the most, is a very, very significant letter. It's a three-pronged letter. When I worked with kids, you know, when I needed them to be quiet already, I taught them the signal like this, Shin for shh, Sheket Bavakasha, quiet please, Sha, be quiet. And there's all sorts of associations with that. It has three stems, three heads, equaling three worlds. This world, the world of the Messianic age, and the world to come. Three primary colors of the rainbow. And then there's the three-prong Shin and the four-prong Shin. The positive space and the negative space. And on phylacteries, on tefillin, the phylactery for the head has a four-prong Shin. So there's the visible and the invisible. I did a project, actually it was a Rosh Hashanah sermon about how art related to the process of repentance, of teshuvah, of turning our behavior around. And I had seen a show of Aboriginal Australian art. And in that artistic tradition, there's no empty space. So the idea of letters, of Hebrew letters, being both the positive space of the letter form itself and the charged space around it, really, it was cool to see those two traditions echoing one another. Here are some other fun things about letters. Kabbalah does a lot of work. I'm not going to get into this a whole lot right now, but there's even Aleph Bet yoga for kids. And it's a good kinetic activity to teach kids more about the letters. And here you can see how the different parts of the letter Aleph have the letters for God's name that is unpronounceable as a word. I have some handouts here, if you want, of examples of these stories. There's one, before I do a little bit of demonstration, oh, I should have been watching the time better.
Yeah, because it's dinner time.
Yeah. Yeah, dinner is coming, and food is important.
It is.
But, well, okay. I can give you about 4 minutes worth, but I just want to share one other midrash. Moses as a calligrapher. Rabbi Simeon ben Lakish said, the Torah given to Moses was written with black fire upon white fire, sealed with fire, and swathed with bands of fire. While writing it, Moses wiped off the reed on his hair. Thus he received radiance that was to emanate from his countenance. Michelangelo made a little mistake when he did a famous sculpture of Moses. He shows Moses with horns, yeah. And that's a mistranslation. What is said about Moses is that he had rays of light emanating from his head. So here, this Midrash says it's because he wiped the calligraphic pen that he was using to write scripture on his hair, and that's how he got the radiance, because of this whole repeated idea of Hebrew letters being written with black fire and white fire to make these sacred documents. So I have some examples of how Hebrew letters are formed. I apologize. I have used these in a Hebrew reading context, and when I grabbed them on my way here, I should have taken the time to write the names of the letters on them. I apologize for that. But there's some simple block lettering on one side, and then calligraphic lettering showing how to do that on the other side. Like I said, I also have examples of some of the storytelling that we talked about. And then these are some of the calligraphic strokes that you use. I can put them on the table here if you'd like to take them.